is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Bill Raggio and Tom Jossen. They are senior fellows, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, watching the vast canvas of the Ummah from the Mediterranean to the Hindu Kush. We begin, however, with Tom's remarks before the Senate Armed Services Committee some days past about after the American withdrawal, after the ISAF withdrawal, after right now NATO having no good ears or eyes inside the region, what is next? And that involves a variety of possibilities. Tom, a very good evening to you. Thank you for this. Your testimony begins with what we have now in Afghanistan is what we've had before, but it's now revealed without American interference. We have Al-Qaeda, we have ISIS, and we have an awakened Taliban recruiting across the region. First of all, your remarks about Al-Qaeda, how were they greeted by the Senate Armed Services Committee? Are they at least informed that Al-Qaeda never left the region? Good evening, Tom.
Good evening, John. You know, it was kind of interesting testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee. I didn't find any disagreement among Democrats or Republicans that Al-Qaeda has been there all along. Nobody seemed to be surprised by that. Nobody seemed to disagree with it. You know, basically going in, I had my point of my testimony was to make really two broad arguments. The first was that U.S. military leadership and really the political leadership of America didn't understand the insurgency or the status of the insurgency. And you remember that Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, has been going around, General Milley has been going around saying that the Afghan government fell in 11 days. And this was repeated by some of the senators who were there. But, you know, John, we've talked about this so many times. You've been following Bill's work, you know, with his map that he was documenting meticulously for so long. You know that it didn't fall in 11 days. You know that there was a much longer plan in motion here. And really, the final offensive was really 3.5 months from May 1st to mid-August. So the first point was that basically nobody who was a decision maker here, a policy maker here, really understood the insurgency. And that's really scandalous. The second thing is that just as they didn't understand the insurgency, they didn't understand the insurgents. So you hear some of the top leadership now saying that Al-Qaeda is going to be reconstituted or they're going to make a comeback in Afghanistan. And surely some senior Al-Qaeda leaders are going to make their way back to Afghanistan. Some fighters are going to relocate to Afghanistan. But that was the second point of my testimony, was that Al-Qaeda was there all along. And not only were they there all along, they helped the Taliban win the war.
The ISIS presence was a great concern to the American media towards the close of the American withdrawal. ISIS was blamed for the suicide vest attack on Afghan and American around the airport, leading to the death of 13. Was the committee and its staff concerned about that attack, about ISIS and about ISIS's relationship?
I mean, certainly they were. And I mean, ISIS has an ongoing presence in Afghanistan. We've seen that they've had some small scale attacks on Taliban convoys using improvised explosive devices. And they've now, you know, been attacking mosques, which are sort of low hanging fruit, easy civilian targets for ISIS to go hit. And certainly ISIS posed a threat to the U.S. presence in Afghanistan right through the very end there, as we saw. I just think that when you look at the broader picture, the U.S. leadership, again, one of the things that happened here was they became myopically obsessed with ISIS as the Taliban Al-Qaeda, the unbroken Taliban Al-Qaeda axis, was taking over the country. And this goes to show sort of the myopia that set in within the American political and military leadership on this war. But ISIS is still there. They still have a presence. You know, a lot of times the ISIS presence is really an offshoot from the Taliban Al-Qaeda. You know, the earliest ISIS commanders were really defectors, guys who were upset with the chain of command within their existing organizations for one reason or another. You're going to see ISIS, you know, is going to have a lingering presence in Afghanistan for sure, and it have a presence in Pakistan. But, you know, at no point in time were they able to take over the country the way the Taliban and Al-Qaeda were. And, you know, a lot of the analysis that we're seeing basically is downplaying the fact that these insurgents, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, were the master insurgents who won the war at the expense of the terrorists. You know, ISIS is really more of a limited terrorist organization. It's able to conduct terrorist operations. And this is an important point, John, because what I found in testifying and talking to people in the leadership is they don't understand that insurgents are basically an evolved form of terrorists, right? The terrorists are sort of a lesser species on the scale of political violence than the insurgents are. And yet I've even seen this with people that we, Bill and I know, they seem to have it flipped in their head. They think that the insurgents are the lesser species, which is not the case.
An additional point before the Congress was Pakistan. Pakistan's contribution to the Taliban victory and Pakistan's ongoing relationship with the Taliban. Your understanding, does the Senate Armed Services Committee see that Pakistan is an inconstant threat and that the stability in the region cannot be achieved by empowering a state such as Pakistan?
You know, I don't think anybody pushed back at the Senate Armed Services Committee about my comments about Pakistan. Obviously, everybody knows they sponsored and harbored the Taliban leadership and facilitation networks and parts of Al-Qaeda even, and helped them win the war. And this external sanctuary from Afghanistan south in Pakistan was a big deal for the insurgents. You know, John, I'll point out that I also testified last week for the Senate Banking Committee, which we have to post that testimony at Longword Journal as well. And one of the things I figured out while doing the research for that testimony was that the U.S. gave Pakistan since 2001 more than $30 billion in military assistance aid and military reimbursements. And the point I used there was that did not provide the U.S. with leverage over the Pakistani state when it came to harboring the very same actors who were targeting Americans and Afghans in Afghanistan. And the reason why I brought that up with Senate Banking Committee was that, you know, you're seeing in Washington now this idea that U.S. can have leverage over the Taliban with humanitarian aid and assistance. And I made two points on that. One, the U.S. hasn't had any leverage over the Taliban in 25 years. We have a quarter of a century of history here. There's no reason to think that at any point in time America had leverage over the Taliban, and there's no reason to think they do now. And two, this more than $30 billion in aid, which is certainly more than the Taliban is going to receive, didn't provide the U.S. with leverage over the Pakistani state. So I think that this is just trying to debunk this idea that Washington has a hand to play here going forward.
And in general, Tom, would you say that the Senate Armed Services Committee presented staff and senators an informed view of the region is unstable and threatening going forward? Or did they treat this region as a rearview mirror, no longer our major concern?
You know, I don't think they put it in the rearview mirror. I think that that there was still an expressing ongoing concern, but I don't know how much anybody really was willing to do anything about it. That's the bottom line. And I think we've reached a point where America lost this war, and so now you have people just want to be on the record as saying that there is an ongoing threat still from the region, but nobody really knows how to handle it.
We turn to how to handle it because the presenting case right now is that the Taliban is organizing a government. And Bill, just quickly, you have an item about the Taliban Minister of Interior issuing passports, Afghan passports. Your understanding, these passports, are they to be acknowledged when the members of the Taliban travel? Are they going to issue passports to unknowns, for example, allowing bad actors access to airlines, to airports and capitals that heretofore would have blocked them?
Hello, John. Yes. So those are the questions, right? How will these passports be treated by countries outside of Afghanistan, by where the Taliban and others will travel? So the passports are being issued by Sirajuddin Haqqani, who runs the Interior Ministry. And of course, he's an Al-Qaeda leader. He's the deputy emir of the state. He's one of the most powerful Taliban leaders with close ties to Al-Qaeda, one of many Taliban leaders as such. And he, I'm stating the obvious here now, but he now has the power to issue passports to basically to whoever he wants. Think about that, post September 11th, the travel of foreign jihadists, this is something to be monitored and to be concerned about. Now, today, you have a terrorist state issuing passports for people to travel. Now, you could argue, well, that's fine. Any passports issued after a certain date, they should be tracked and whatnot. But they have access to all of the passport material from the previous Afghan government. They could backdate information. They can do anything they want. They have the tools of the state to issue official documents. And would Siraj Haqqani issue passports to members of Al-Qaeda and other foreign terrorist groups? I certainly wouldn't put it past them. They've relied on them to help conquer Afghanistan. And there's going to be payback. This is something I don't think, you know, I don't think this is understood whatsoever within the U.S. government, within U.S. national security establishment. I know there's individuals working these issues who are very concerned, but I don't think our policymakers, our politicians have grasped the significance of the Taliban takeover. They just see it as a bad thing, as something unwanted. But I really don't think they understand the gravity that you have a terrorist state that is ready, willing, and able to support foreign terrorists.
I'm speaking to Bill Rajo and Tom Joslin. They are senior fellows, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. They keep the Long War Journal, a chronology and analysis of the vast Ummah. And we're concentrating on Afghanistan because it's going through transformations that are puzzling and non-transparent. The U.S. does not have good eyes and ears in the region, I'm told. I read. So when we come back, what does that mean about stability going forward, especially organizations that are now attracted to basing in Afghanistan, in the terror state, question mark? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Tom Joslin and Bill Rajo of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. And we're exploring what happens after the fall of Afghanistan to the Taliban, or Afghanistan now ruled by a terror organization that has kindred spirits all through the region and around the world because of Al-Qaeda, because of ISIS, and because of Pakistan being a sponsor of the Taliban at one point. And Tom, before I turn to Bill's report on the TTP, was there emphasis in your testimony, either to banking or to the Senate Armed Services Committee, that Pakistan is part of the challenge going forward for the Biden administration? I understand you told them what the problem is, but is your sense that they're gathering more resources, that they're asking harder questions, that they are ready to solve these years of the double game that Pakistan has played?
No. In short, John, I don't have any sense that there's any sea change in how the Washington leader perceiving this. In fact, you can look at the Biden administration, they're treating Pakistan now as currently as a partner and an ally going forward in all this still, even after all this. And it just goes to show that really, once these sort of policy tracks are laid down and once people assume that nations like Pakistan or Qatar or any of these other duplicitous actors are firmly America's ally, it's almost impossible to talk them out of it. You know, you can see that the State Department has been meeting with the Pakistanis and even meeting with the Taliban. You know, other than getting the American citizens who remain in Afghanistan out of Afghanistan, why would the U.S. be meeting with these parties at this point? These are the parties that beat them, defeated them. And yet there's this incessant sort of desire for servile diplomacy to have Americans go and prostrate themselves before these actors indefinitely. And so we seem to have replaced now endless war with endless servile diplomacy.
Bill, I come to you on your report of the Taliban in Pakistan, the acronym being TTP. What is it and what is new about it and what is the threat?
The TTP stands for the Tehrik-e-Taliban in Pakistan, or the Movement of the Taliban in Pakistan. This is the Pakistani branch of the Taliban. It was formed in December 2007. Its leaders swear allegiance to to the Taliban's leader, and it receives direction from Al-Qaeda. We found this strong evidence of this within Osama bin Laden's files. It wants to do in Pakistan what the Afghan Taliban did in Afghanistan, which is take over the country and impose Sharia. It supports foreign terrorist groups, and the TTP has been it seized control of much of northwestern Pakistan from 2007 up to about 2011 or 12. The Pakistani military, which has supported the TTP or quietly supported it or tolerated it, the Pakistani government has signed peace deals with the TTP in the past, which have ceded control of territory, and it and then which of course the TTP violated the terms of these agreements and continued to take territory. But once they got to 60 miles of Islamabad in 2009-10, the military was forced to take action, and they've beaten them back, but they were never defeated, just like the Taliban in Afghanistan wasn't defeated after the U.S. invasion in 2001. Its leaders fled across the border, went into safe havens within Pakistan, and it's maintained its insurgency. It suffered a downtick with the Pakistani military offensive. By 2014, it was a divided organization, and now it's reorganizing. It's putting the band back together, getting all these various groups that had split off after a controversial appointment of its last leader, Mullah Fazullah. The U.S. killed him in a strike in Afghanistan in 2018, and its new leader, Nur Wali Massoud, is trying, again, putting that band back together, getting all these various groups back. They've been launching attacks against the Pakistani military and killing soldiers. It's been low scale stuff, but we've been watching it ramp up over the last year plus. So, and now with the success of the Afghan Taliban, the TTP is probably sensing, or maybe it could smell its own version of success. And it now has real safe haven inside of Afghanistan. With the Taliban, it had shelter in Afghanistan in areas that the Taliban controlled, but was always in danger of being targeted by the U.S. military, and it was. But now those threats to the TPP are gone. They can move back and forth across that border at will, and get covert support from the Afghan Taliban, and they're gonna make a play for Pakistan.
Bill, you've reported previously that there was an opinion in ISAF and maybe in Islamabad as well, that there's such a thing as a good Taliban and the bad Taliban. The good Taliban, this is a scorecard that no longer is out of date. The good Taliban was the Afghan Taliban and the Lashkar-e-Taiba. The bad Taliban was the TTP. Is that still the opinion in the region, or what is the wheel of jihad?
Yeah, that was the Pakistani, and still is the Pakistani construct. So the Afghan Taliban, groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba and a host of Pakistani stood up jihadist groups, Harkat al-Mujahideen, who, you know, you go on and on with the alphabet soup of the Pakistani terrorist groups that the Pakistani state has supported to wage jihad in Kashmir. These are the good Taliban. They're the so-called strategic depth that the Pakistani state uses against India for its foreign policy objectives. The bad Taliban would be groups like the TTP, Al-Qaeda most of the time, things of that nature. Also, the Afghan Taliban would be the good Taliban. So this is a view from the Pakistani state. And Tom coined the word term wheel of jihad, and I just love it. It makes perfect sense. So here it is in a nutshell. You have the Afghan Taliban. They're considered the good Taliban by the Pakistani state. It supports the Pakistani Taliban, which attacks the Pakistani state, and there you have it. And then the Pakistani state continues to support the Afghan Taliban. It just goes on and on and on. And this is a situation. This is where the Pakistani state, but not the Pakistani people, certainly deserve what they get when the TTP was launching terror attacks against general headquarters in Rawalpindi. You know, it was hard to feel sympathetic towards the Pakistani military and the Pakistani Inter-Service Intelligence Directorate when this was the monster that it all created. Right. And it still refused to deal with it, because the Afghan Taliban is still the good Taliban.
We're going to turn to another member of that wheel of jihad when we come back, Al-Qaeda. Tom Jostin, Bill Raggio, Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. This is CBSI in the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Bill Raggio and Tom Jostin. They're senior fellows, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. They and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal. At the Long War Journal, they also have a podcast when they're not busy testifying in Washington or explaining what's happened in Afghanistan sometime between the middle of August 2021 and right now. We're going to turn to Al-Qaeda now, because Al-Qaeda has never left the region, is very active in the region, and I include the region of all of Central Asia, all of Eurasia. And the evidence is obvious when you come to the videos that Al-Qaeda makes. Right now, Tom has done us the favor of writing up the revelations from a video from AQAPs, that's Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Ibrahim Al-Qosi. It is extremely, extremely articulate about Al-Qaeda now, Al-Qaeda in the immediate future, and Al-Qaeda's ability to broadcast, to convey, to propagandize, to inform its recruits and its members. Tom, this is a fascination given that Al-Qaeda again and again shows that it is the match for how Western reporters present the struggle these last 20 years. First, we better do some definitions. Who is Ibrahim Al-Qosi to make this video? What status does he have in Al-Qaeda?
John, Ibrahim Al-Qosi is a Sudanese Al-Qaeda veteran. He worked for bin Laden personally during the 1990s in a variety of roles, including working on the finances for Al-Qaeda. But he also went and fought and waged jihad in various theaters or attempted to. He escaped from Tora Bora in late 2001 and was captured by the by U.S. allies or partners at the time, was turned over to the U.S. and was imprisoned at Guantanamo, became detainee at Guantanamo until about 2012. The Obama administration then cut a deal with him and as basically to be a witness in certain military commission trials, and they let him go. You know, at the time, there was reporting that he was just, you know, sort of a low level Al-Qaeda flunky. And I looked at his dossier and said, no way. This is a guy who was a fully made man within Al-Qaeda and was personally working for Osama bin Laden. And I profiled him at the time as somebody who could probably take on a senior leadership role once he was released. He certainly did. He very quickly, he absconded from Sudan to Yemen and became a senior figure in AQAP. That's Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And indeed, we suspect that he's beyond that. That he's actually part of the Al-Qaeda management staff globally, if you look at the way he speaks. And he's somebody who's well known to counterterrorism officials and intelligence forces around the world. So when Al-Qaeda puts him on camera, he has the pedigree of being somebody who has been in this game for a very long time and is a respected veteran in Al-Qaeda circles. But on top of that, they're not really worried about the U.S. Catching up with him and droning him to death. This is a guy who's basically been in the game for decades, and he's sort of a well-known figure. So they rely on him to issue this stern warning to the Americans on behalf of Al-Qaeda, not just Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, but indeed Al-Qaeda globally.
His remarks are surprisingly complex, Tom, if I just read a little of what you've produced for us. First of all, he's addressing the whole world, Muslims in general, he says. To begin, I would like to congratulate and salute the Muslims in general, then the people of Afghanistan and the Taliban movement, and on top of them, the Emir of the Faithful, Akhundzada, and his distinguished commanders and soldiers in particular, for this magnificent victory and evident conquest that shocked the world and all politicians and observers. I find nothing wrong with the facts when he's congratulating his side. Does he speak for Al-Qaeda? Is this a man who has the comparable weight of Zawahiri of Al-Qaeda?
He has a lot of weight within Al-Qaeda circles. He's certainly speaking for Al-Qaeda globally here. And the message is not only that, you know, congratulating the Ummah or the worldwide community of Muslims on the victory in Afghanistan, but he's making two additional arguments on top of that. He's saying that, look, just because we won in Afghanistan doesn't mean our war against you, America, is over. You don't get it. We hate you. And he hitches it to bin Laden's archival rhetoric about, you know, the American policy and how American policy is to blame for all this, which, of course, there's a lot of problems with that argument. But that's been their talking point all along, is that it's really that America's presence or activities anywhere really throughout the Middle East or really the world basically are a problem for them when you examine them closely what they believe. But then what's interesting about this, John, is he makes a very pointed claim. He says that he doesn't just talk about attacking America or the West in general. He specifically refers to upcoming Mujahideen operations or upcoming operations by the Mujahideen. This is a very specific threat. And he says that they don't need to be a carbon copy of 9/11 in order to be effective. He's saying there are other ways we can attack you. And he's not talking in the abstract as if they may try and attack us again. He's claiming, at least in this video, that they have things under, you know, there are plots afoot, that they are actually, in fact, coming.
He mentions President Bush's speech. So this is a product of research. This presentation has been arranged as a way of marking where we are in time. And you report that he spends a deal of time discussing President Biden's remarks on August 16th and August 31st about the cost of the Afghan war. Who is the audience for this? I mean, he's making an argument almost as if he represented a sovereign power.
I mean, he's basically saying not only did America lose the war, but look at the costs incurred on America for losing it. And all they got out of it, according to him, looking at President Biden's rhetoric, is that, you know, the U.S. finally got Osama bin Laden in May 2011. And they got this, you know, this completely flimsy counterterrorism assurance from the Taliban, which is nobody should trust, that they won't allow, you know, Afghan soil to be used against others. And basically saying, based on your own reasoning, he's addressing the president of the United States. Was it worth it? That's what you spent, you know, hundreds of billions. And he claims over $2 trillion, which is a figure that's cited often. I don't really agree with that figure, but that's the commonly cited figure. That was over $2 trillion spent and all the casualties. Was it, given these high costs, was it worth it for those two things? And of course, he's leading the listener or the viewer to the answer that the answer is no. And that here we are still standing after all this time. We being Al-Qaeda on his behalf, he's saying on his behalf, they're still standing and they're still waiting to come for us.
Your security is still at risk, O Americans, as you do not comprehend the lesson in all its aspects. And as long as you do not act to remove the reasons for which the September 11th events took place. And then he goes on to say, Tom, this looks like a new bill of particulars to charge America in the docket. And if I read your presentation correctly, he's basing it not on American presence in Saudi Arabia. I believe that was one of the original predicates for bin Laden's jihad. The U.S. had troops in Saudi Arabia, his land of two kingdoms. But also they're referring back again to Palestine and Israel. So they're using the anti-Semitic tropes that have been popular in Palestine only. As a justification for their jihad, is that what they're hanging everything on, Palestine?
Yeah, they've been doing this all along, John. It's actually an old bill. It's an old indictment, really, it's an old conspiratorial indictment. You know, every time Al-Qaeda says something like this, I have to remind people that this is an organization that takes the elders of the Protocols of Zion as a foundational document, right, as an historical document. We all know that that's conspiratorial gobbledygook. And yet they consider this sort of a bedrock document in their whole conspiracy of this Zionist crusader conspiracy against the West. So, you know, they have a deeply anti-Semitic view of all this. And, you know, this is why, you know, if you look back, by the way, John, Ben Rhodes, who was the national security advisor, he was the national security spokesman, I'm sorry, for President Obama for 8 years and really was his right hand man. You know, he cited Al-Qaeda's rhetoric on American policy as if they have a point, as if it does justify what they're doing. You can see this in his writings. And this goes to show just how pathetic the American elite are, really, that they don't even understand that they're citing anti-Semitic tropes, as you say, John, and empowering it and pretending like there's actually some truth there when really it's just nonsense. And, you know, my point is that this sounds crazy and it is crazy, but there are enough people that are stupid enough to actually buy it, even including in the U.S.
And Bill, because you watch the Afghanistan Taliban, I have to be careful of which Taliban I'm talking about here. Carefully, this video presumes the Afghan Taliban is part of the larger operation with ambitions to punish or continue to punish America. Do you see echoes of this in the Afghan Taliban's remarks or propaganda? Have they spoken in any fashion about Al-Qaeda's claims here, Al-Qusi's claims, that they're a regiment in our army?
The Afghan Taliban's just before and since its victory in Afghanistan have been very careful to not jump into the Al-Qaeda camp here. So they haven't commented on this video and other, not that we have been able to detect publicly anyway. But the Taliban has, for over the last several years, over the last decade, blamed the United States for 9/11, said we deserved it. It was a slap on our dark face. I mean, this was all these words, statements and videos produced while the U.S. was negotiating with the Taliban. So we know that the Afghan Taliban share Al-Qaeda's view of its hatred for the United States, that the U.S. deserves what it gets, that we're deserving of these terror attacks. But it's trying to craft itself as a government. It doesn't want to, at least at this point in time, show its cards with Al-Qaeda, that it's of its cooperation with Al-Qaeda. And it's just playing a very careful game so it doesn't draw the U.S. or air back in or airstrikes or anything like that. Not that I believe that the U.S. would even go back in Afghanistan at this point in time, because that would be such an admission of failure by the Biden administration. But it would still could risk airstrikes. The Taliban is also trying to get the foreign aid. The U.S. has agreed to provide cash to provide aid to the Afghans. You could see what I think about that. It's very likely a bribe to get Americans out of the country. But yeah, the Taliban is playing a very careful game right now as so as not to expose its ties and make it life difficult for itself. And Al-Qaeda is just fine with that. Al-Qaeda has been on board with that strategy for the last decade. It understands that an Afghanistan controlled by the Taliban is in its best interest.
And in a detail, Tom, about the production of this video, Al-Malaham Media for AQAP, including video of Vietnam and of the exit from Afghanistan in mid-August. Is that correct? In other words, they took their time to put together a complete education for their recruits. Is that what you're reporting here?
Yeah, you know, they absolutely. In fact, I just gave one still shot or one screenshot from the video. They had multiple images from both comparing the U.S. humiliating U.S. withdrawal from Vietnam, the humiliating withdrawal from Afghanistan. And, you know, this is, you know, part of the point here that people miss, I think, a lot of times is that Al-Qaeda actually studied America in the Vietnam War. They had studied the insurgents in Vietnam in particular and how they defeated the Americans. And they adopted a lot of their lessons from that experience. And they know the historical framing here, that there is a message that has quite strong and potent here in terms of anti-Americanism. I mean, you can see even Ibrahim al-Qosi in his speech, he says, you know, that America has been exposed as it's not a superpower anymore after the war in Afghanistan, that this once great, mighty power, America, has been shown to be what it is, which is completely feckless. And in fact, I hate to say it as an American, but I think he has a point.
Not only does he have a point, it's similar to a point we could find in Beijing and Moscow on any given day. So al-Qosi is speaking as if he represents, well, I wouldn't say it was a nation. I would say it is a transnational organization. And we're going to turn to one aspect of this transnational organization that is dissenting from al-Qosi, and that's ISIS and the attack, what we know so far of the attack at Kunduz of a Shiite mosque. What does that mean for Afghanistan, for the Taliban, and for al-Qaeda? Tom Jossin, Bill Rajo, they are senior fellows, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. They keep the Long War Journal. This is CBSI on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBSI on the World with John Batchelor.
CBSI in the World. I'm John Batchelor with Bill Rajo and Tom Jossin of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. They and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal. We're looking now at reports from Al Jazeera in English. This is headquartered in Qatar. And the Al Jazeera offices are sympathetic often to the events in the Ummah that are not easily accessed by reporters, say, from France or from Britain. So therefore, I read Al Jazeera very carefully for events such as the bombing in the Shiite mosque in Kunduz. There's a mix here of tragedy and at the same time, political intentions. The headlines, this is Al Jazeera, dozens killed in suicide bombing at Kunduz mosque. ISIL, that is Al Jazeera's name for ISIS or ISIS-K, affiliate claims responsibility for the blast at the Shia mosque in Kunduz that has killed dozens. Now, this is a blast that was during a worship, and Al Jazeera goes on to report that the suicide bomber was a Uyghur Muslim who objects to the Afghanistan policy of ignoring the rightly claims of the Uyghurs who are being persecuted by the Chinese authorities. You see how complicated this is getting. This is not about back to Washington. This is aiming of a finger of blame at Beijing. The Chinese Communist Party is involved in this. But more to the point, the bomber killed Shiites. Shiites are a minority in Afghanistan, but they are the dominant religion in Persia, in Iran. Shiites are also persecuted by ISIS, which claims to be, there's no adequate word for it. It's a hate organization directed at the Shiites as a minority in all of Ummah. Bill, I'm exhausted trying to explain this. What I want help from you on is that ISIS can murder maybe 50, maybe 100 worshipers and damage the confidence of Kunduz and then the whole of Afghanistan. So while we've not treated ISIS as a military force, as a terror organization, it is doing to the Taliban what ISIS and Al-Qaeda have done to Europe and America these many years. Am I reading this correctly, Bill?
Yes, John, that's essentially correct. It's also doing what the Taliban did to the U.S., although the Taliban had a second aspect of that, which was taking in territory. But the Taliban was also, it's responsible for launching numerous attacks within mosques. It killed senior government officials. I remember a turban suicide bomber in Kandahar. I believe it killed the brother of Hamid Karzai, if I'm correct. That was like in 2010-11. So, and it's conducted suicide attacks. And so this is sort of the fruits of the Taliban's labor over the last 20 years, the Islamic State. This is the more, they're confined to just conducting suicide attacks because it doesn't have the ability to take and hold territory. The Taliban's far too strong for the Islamic State to do that at this point in time. And also, this is a result in some ways, and this is something where the Taliban is creating a weakness for itself. Its willingness to conduct talks with and negotiations with the Chinese, this is going to anger a certain element of the jihadist community, particularly Uyghurs. So Uyghurs that are part of the Turkestan Islamic Party that have fought alongside Al-Qaeda, if you're not happy with that deal, you now have an outlet within Afghanistan, and that's the Islamic State. So the Islamic State may benefit from the Taliban's willingness to play the international game, to talk, to negotiate with countries like China, which has repressed millions and millions of Uyghurs and thrown them in concentration camps. And, we talk with Russia and talk with Pakistan, which some of these jihadists don't like, despite Pakistan's support for it, and talking to Iran. So that's where the Islamic State may have an advantage going forward. And it's why it would behoove the Taliban to snuff this problem out quickly. Whether it has the capacity to do so, we're going to find out.
Right. The Al Jazeera reports that raids are conducted by Taliban authorities in Jalalabad, where there was a bombing of a convoy some weeks past, and in Kabul. And that's non-transparent, so I'm not going to pursue that. Instead, Tom, is there an understanding in Washington of the complications here of a Uyghur who is said to be, or the Beijing authorities treat Uyghurs as enemies, as terrorists, a Uyghur suicide bomber in a Kunduz mosque against Shiites and upsetting the Taliban and leading to disorder? Does Washington, do the representatives of our elected government understand how complicated this is going to get and that America cannot simply walk away?
I don't think so. I had the same thoughts that Bill did when I saw this suicide bomber was identified as a Uyghur. This is an ongoing liability for the Taliban that they've supposedly provided assurances to Beijing that they will prevent the Turkestan Islamic Party, which is part of Al-Qaeda, from conducting operations in Xinjiang from Afghan soil. There are various workarounds around that, I would say, that could include allowing them to, for example, go after Chinese assets in Pakistan. But I think that this is an ongoing problem for them. And I do wonder if that assurance, which has been made, basically drives some of the Uyghur fighters into the ISIS camp here. And that was the first thought I had watching this. Now, to date, the Uyghur presence in Afghanistan has remained mostly loyal to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. I don't think there'll be a wholesale defection, or that you see a lot of them going away in droves. But I do wonder at the margins if this isn't going to allow ISIS to pick off some jihadis.
And ISIS calls them, Tom, just 30 seconds, ISIS calls the Taliban, quote, dirty nationalists, saying they have got a global jihad where Afghanistan is just issuing passports. That will continue to bite. Don't you agree, Tom?
Yeah, well, I mean, it may bite in some sense, but only for the ignorant. I mean, they also refer to the Taliban as a militia, right? But right. I mean, are they a militia? They just took over the country. So, I think that really the ISIS argument is only going to resonate with the people who are the uninitiated.
Tom Jossen, Bill Raggio, they keep the Long War Journal for the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. They also, when they have time, do a wonderful podcast that summarizes all these events that are tumbling around us after Afghanistan. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.